Thank you for listening to the Following Films podcast. Today I'm joined by director of photography Eric Steelberg to talk about his work on the latest Ghostbusters film, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. The film is currently in theaters and marks the fifth installment in the Ghostbusters franchise. The film stars Finn Wolfhard, Paul Rudd, Ernie Hudson, and McKenna Grace. It's a great film. I had a ton of fun with it, and I love where this series is headed. I had him on the show to talk about Ghostbusters, but we also ended up talking about his next project with his another collaboration with Jason Reitman, where he's working on SNL 75. And so we spent actually quite a bit of the time talking about that film as well. It seems like every time I chat with Eric, we're talking about not only the thing he's working on, but the thing he has coming up next. The last time I had him on, he was on the show to talk about Ahsoka. And so we were talking about Star Wars, but then the next thing he had coming out was a Ghostbusters film. So every time I seem to chat with him, I'm talking about reliving my childhood through his current endeavors. And always have a great time chatting with him, and hope to get to chat with him again on the next one, on that SNL film. So I hope you enjoy the show. Thanks. Thank you so much for taking time out of your Sunday to do this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, not a problem.
So my son here, he watched the movie with me, and he wanted to ask you a quick question before, if that's okay.
Yeah, of course.
My question is, how long did it take each day? How long did he have to stay each day?
We actually filmed the movie 10 hours every day.
What?
Because we work in England, and every day you have to, they limit you to working about 10 hours. But in the US, you can usually work longer, like 12, 13 hours. Yeah. That's cool, but that's still a long time.
Awesome. Well, thank you, buddy.
Thanks.
Good question.
See you later, Eric.
Bye. Bye.
He really loved the movie and wanted a chance to meet somebody that was involved with the movie. So, yeah.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
I got two kids myself, so that's awesome.
Bye, buddy. How old are your kids?
19 and 16. A little older, two boys, but still very much into movies, so I love it.
That's great. So are they going to take on the family business then, or?
My older will not. He's going into the sciences. My younger, he's interested in writing, but he's he just made his first short film, so we'll see.
Nice. That's great, man.
On his own. He's taking a film class in high school, so he's really enjoying it.
How were you able to take that leap? I understand how somebody who sees that and they see their dad or, you know, their mom or somebody they know that's involved in the business. And it feels like it's a doable job. They can see it as a job. That's what dad does. How did you make that transition? Cause it's something that just seems impenetrable from the outside.
I was obsessed with movies when I was a kid. So right when we grew up in the '80s and home video was becoming a thing. Yeah. And that so I loved going to the movies, right, in the theater with my parents. But then the movies I loved, the idea that I could watch those movies that I loved in the theater at home was amazing. And then I, like any kid in the 80s, you become obsessed with certain movies and you would just wear out the tape, you know. And we had like a Betamax, we had Laserdisc, my dad was very into like, you know, home audio and theater stuff, you know, the early 80s. And so he got all the stuff. So we had Laserdisc and Betamax and whatever. And I would just, and he just got whatever was available. And it mostly, it was big movies, right? It's big studio movies at first. And so I grew up on like Spielberg and Zemeckis and Donner and all that stuff. And that's just what I knew. And I was just so obsessed with the storytelling. And I also loved photography. Like I loved my parents' National Geographic magazines. And so when I was older, me and my friends would make, you know, use our parents' VHS cameras or high eight cameras and make movies, like stupid movies with ourselves on the weekends. And then in high school, started making more short films. And I actually started a film program at my private high school that I went to with some friends. And we started shooting Super 8 movies and whatever. And like, I didn't ever really think about what I wanted to do in life. I just knew what interested me. I mean, I also liked airplanes. I was interested in being a pilot, but you know, something about movies was so magical. I mean, my father was a lawyer, so it had nothing to do with the business. And I knew some kids whose parents were in the business, but I never would dare talk to them about it. And I just think it was ignorance thinking that, oh, maybe this is interest will turn into something someday. And nobody really ever said you can't do that. I mean, I grew up in LA, so kind of anything's possible. And I think back then, which actually is a long time ago, it doesn't seem like a long time ago in my mind, but like in the grand scheme of things and how the business has changed, it was a long time ago. It was a very different business in the late 90s, is that it was harder to get into, but there were also less people trying to get into it, it seemed. I mean, there's always at any given time seemed like there's a lot of people trying to get into this relative to what it is. But like now, I wouldn't even know it. I just, there's everybody, because it becomes so accessible, you know, with YouTube and laptops that you can edit movies on and, you know, HD video on your iPhone. It's just like, it's crazy. But back when I was doing it, it was like, if you wanted to do something, you wanted to be seen to take it seriously, it's like you had to shoot on film.
Yeah.
And I was just lucky enough to have friends that all wanted to sort of do the same thing. And I was the only person that was both interested in movies and photography, like still photography, and like had a light meter. So I was kind of just thrust into, they're like, well, you're interested in it and you have a light meter, so just do it. And I was like, okay, but I also like all these other things and I like special effects. Like, yeah, 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 but you're good at photography. And I was like, okay. So I just ended up always being, by virtue of like having an interest in photography and being mechanically inclined and like loving how cameras worked and knowing how to use a light meter and how to develop film, like I became a photographer while all my other friends wanted to direct and produce. Right. So I was the only person, all my friends who wanted to produce and direct, that knew anything about photography. So it was really easy for me to fill that need. So sure. I kind of just got put into that situation so many times that I was like, oh, well, I enjoy it. It's very fun. And I guess I kind of know what I'm doing, sort of. I mean, I understand the process, put it that way. Creatively, I might not know what I'm doing, but like, you know, technically I know what I'm doing and I understand the process. So, which at the time, it being film, was still very mystifying to a lot of other people. So that gave me a leg up and I just kind of fell into it. And I fell into the love of it. And that's kind of how it spiraled. And just by knowing all these other people that wanted to do things like direct and produce, I got to have the opportunity to work on a lot of different short films, which then led to commercials, which then led to, you know, very small feature film, additional photography and things like that, and no budget movies.
Yeah.
And it just kind of all went from there. And then along the way, I met Jason Reitman. We were teenagers and he did some short films in college and said, hey, I remember you used to do, you know, did you used to like make short films in high school when we met? And I was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's like, you're still into that? I'm like, yeah. He's like, I'm going to do a short film. You want to help out? I'm like, yeah, of course. You know, and you just, it was as simple as that, you know, and I was fortunate that him and a couple other friends did very well with short films at the time when short films were finding distribution opportunities and doing well at festivals, that I just had some short films that did well and got a lot of attention. And I was able to kind of move along with a couple of directors and their careers. And it kind of all just happened that way. I don't think it was because I was any good. I just think I was like in the right place in the right time. And I just also didn't know what else to do with my life.
Well, it's worked
out. I don't know what else I would do.
it's worked out.
That's the simple answer to your question that I could have answered 10 minutes ago. It was just like, I didn't know how to do anything else. Well, other than take pictures.
It's like that thing where if you want to be a lead guitarist, you're going to have a tough time, or a singer getting into a band. But if you play bass or drums, you'll have no problem
finding a band.
And I think you're right. The finding your creative voice is something that you have to learn the fundamentals first, and then you can get into the artistry. You have to understand how to make it work, and then you can start expressing yourself through it. It's just that you have to demystify it before.
Yeah. And if you love kind of everything about film, I think, and storytelling and movies, and you understand what everybody, you understand editing, you understand the producing, you understand all the jobs, like, I think it's going to be that much easier as opposed to just focusing only on, or being only interested in the thing that you're actually doing, because then you find yourself being a part of and helping and collaborating with all those other people, as opposed to just being like, oh, he's just the DP. He's just going to show up. He's going to shoot. Like, I could have conversations with everybody. I was actually taking interest in what they were doing and like their problems and their struggles, and they would understand mine. And then we would sort of all help each other get these things made. And I like to think that helped along the way.
Well, it's got to be a pretty surreal experience for you. The last time I talked to you, we were talking about Star Wars. And you're working on that. And then you're working on Ghostbusters. And it's just, you know, I'm 47. So those things were, that was it. So those were my childhood. It's the center of it, were those movies. So do you wake up, even though you're doing it with a friend, you're there with Jason. And then after that, there's that connection, but there's gotta be that thing when people are suiting up and then you see that car. How does that feel for you? What is that like when you see the Ecto-1 or anything like that?
I mean, it's crazy. I mean, it really is. It's I think I mentioned it when we're talking about Ahsoka, but just the anxiety of not wanting to screw it up for the other people that love it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, sure, I love it. And sure, this is my interpretation of what it should look like, how it should feel, whatever. But I hope this is right. I hope I'm contributing in a very meaningful, correct way. It feels amazing. It's very surreal, to be honest. On any of those, the Ghostbusters, Ahsoka, whatever, it's crazy. Like, I would never have believed it if you had told me when I was there shooting those movies on VHS on the weekends with my friends, you know, doing stupid stuff, that, oh, this is all going to lead to, you know, you working on two Ghostbusters movies and maybe a Star Wars TV show. And, you know, and then, you know, by the way, after that, you're going to shoot a movie about the first Saturday Night Live episode on 16 millimeter film. It's like, what?
Yeah, of course.
It's like, it's all, I mean, I don't know how to verbalize it. It's like, it's emotional. It's crazy. It's unbelievable. I still feel like I'm in some sort of a simulation where somebody's just messing with me, you know, where I've been so fortunate and lucky to work on these things, you know, like, I enjoy what I do, but to think that people think I'm good enough to contribute to these projects is just, I don't understand it. I'm happy they do, but like, I don't understand it. And I really enjoy doing it, but I don't understand it. It's very strange.
Just because, and I had questions about Saturday Night Live. I wanted to ask about that project because I'm really excited for that. And the fact that I didn't know that was being shot on 16 millimeter, that actually makes me even more excited for it. That, just what led to that particular decision? I mean, just when I picture the 70s in my mind, I almost see it through that lens where I think about it in this kind of grainy footage that's, and a lot of times it feels like it was shot in a lab that had too many cigarettes being smoked constantly. And it has this look to it when I imagine the 70s.
There's definitely a lot of cigarette smoking. and look, I mean, if we look at the footage and the still photography from that night or that era, it's not grainy, it's low resolution, and it's film that is not quite as good as today, and some of it's limited by how that film was transferred to digital and whatever, and the old video footage, which the video footage is really, really technically poor, but it looks great. And the conversation with Jason was, he's like, I really want people to be there. I really want them to feel, I want it to feel different. I don't want it to feel like a documentary or some, you know, recreation of it. I just want something, a format to make us feel like we're right in it. He was like, I'm thinking 16. And I was like, very nervous. It's like, are you sure? Because if you want this in a theater, like, that's a very big blow up from 16. 35 is already like, that's very large. And it's gonna be grainy. He's like, well, how grainy? I was like, well, we should shoot a test and go look at it in the theater and we'll see. And then it was. And so we determined through testing that if we were going to do it, I said, we've got to shoot it on a slower speed film stock, as opposed to like a higher speed film stock that you would typically do on like a studio shoot. And, cause it's all indoors. And, he's like, well, isn't going to be a lot more light for you? I said, absolutely. He goes, isn't that going to be hard for you? I said, absolutely. But if we're going to do 16, that's the only way we can do it. I mean, that's the truth of it. I was like, I'll figure out the rest, and not sleep very well, but I'll figure it out. And so, and then we did, and we got the studio to, who was understandably nervous about the idea, to get on board with it, and showed them a bunch of tests that we did. And they saw our passion for doing it on that format and saw why we wanted to do it and fully got behind us. And so that's what we're doing.
That's incredible.
We're halfway through the shoot. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. It looks fantastic.
That's the thing. I think that there's 16, some films that I absolutely love that are just beautiful to me are shot on 16 millimeter and they still hold up to this day. It's just, it's that I mean, it's not known for its beauty, but there's a couple of shots recently that I saw in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre that are just incredible. And that thing was shot in 16 and it looks beautiful. There's moments in that restoration they did recently look phenomenal. So yeah,
we're not doing a kind of very affected look with it. We're basically using it for its lower resolution and grain. But using like the most modern 16 camera, the most modern optics. I'm using very old light. I'm using all hard light. I'm using no soft light, and it just looks fantastic with the low resolution. I mean, but when you see it, you're like, oh, I get it. This is the best way I can describe it. It's how the film should look. It's how you want this movie to look. Now, once you see it, you'll be like, yes, I can't imagine it any other way.
So how are you feeling about what's that like now? Because I was also a comedy kid, you know, it was, the 75 stuff I came to much later because I was born in 76, but it's that Saturday Night Live, that was a huge part of my life when I was a kid. That was the only real comedy that I could get when I was young, except for that was on television that I really appreciated until, you know, Kids in the Hall and Mr. Show and these things came later, but it was all, I was definitely influenced pretty profoundly by SNL. So you're going to 30,
same.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. No, same. I mean, like it was for me, I kind of discovered it through seeing originally skits of, Eddie Murphy doing stuff on this show called Saturday Night Live on VHS and going like, oh, what's this show? And they're like, oh, it's this, you know, my friends be like, oh, it's this show that's on every Saturday night. And it's, you know, past your bedtime, but like it's these actors are all, it's comedy. It's these sketch comedy. It's all improv. And that's how it was described to me. It's not improv, but you know, it's very much kind of like, feels like improv, and it's last minute and these things that are written the day before and whatever. I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And then, you know, I'd have sleepovers and we'd always try to stay up to watch it because the parents never really wanted you watching it. And, you know, it was great. And then, you know, later on in the 90s, realizing that things like Wayne's World were born from Saturday Night Live. And, you know, it's cool. It's kind of like, it's a birthplace of so much modern comedy, in film and in just in general. And anyone has been through there. And it's pretty holy in the world of, you know, of comedy and even just acting, you know? So it's, again, you know, a lot of responsibility, telling the story, but this is really fun. It's really charming. And, I hope people really enjoy it.
I'm there. I'm all on board for that one for sure. But okay. There's these moments that happen in life where, things go from black and white to color in your mind, where you've suddenly realized something. You know, it's the apes discovering the monolith in 2001, where you go, oh, this moment of clarity that happens. And Ghostbusters Afterlife, or not Afterlife, I'm sorry, in Frozen Empire has that moment for me. Something that has been a part of my childhood. I barely have memories prior to Ghostbusters, you know, that film. Mm-hmm. It's been such a part of my life. I never realized that Bustin' Makes Me Feel Good was a sex joke. I had no idea that entire time I've been watching this film until I watched this. Do you think it was intended in Ray Parker Jr. when he said that?
I don't think until that moment when Paul said that on set, which was completely improv, that any of us realized it. And we were like, oh, huh. And then the discussion ensued. And much discussion ensued. Paul was like, yeah, we had no idea. We don't know. But given the context in today's, you know, lingo, I guess it could be a sex joke. It certainly turned into a sex joke. It was a good sex joke. It was pretty funny. I like to think that it was completely harmless when he said it in the original. And it's really this, we who have turned it into something it wasn't, but you know what? Hey, keep it alive, keep it going, keep the conversation continuing, you know, as far as I'm concerned.
I like to think that it wasn't Ray Parker Jr.'s intention, but there was somebody in the room that was just giggling in the background to themselves that has known this whole time. I want to believe that somebody.
Oh yeah. Probably Dan and Bill and, you know, Ivan and all those guys. Yeah. I'm sure.
I would hope so.
Ray Parker's like, what's so funny? Not nothing. Yeah.
So then,
don't worry about it.
The other thing that I love about this film is how these movies have moved from this workplace comedy, essentially, to a family film. And it's kind of, I've grown up with this. It was in a way that it was, when I was a kid, it was, oh, this is a comedy about what it's like to have a job. And I was looking to that thinking, is this what a job will be like to some degree? And then now I'm looking at this as a part of my life. You know, that the son, Jacob, that you met a little bit ago, he's autistic, he's on the spectrum. So it's just one of those things, seeing that represented in this film in a way that doesn't call it out is so important to me. And it means so much to see that kind of representation where it's not about that. It's just a part of it. And that, and I adore that about these films, and I will follow them forever because of that little piece, but just it, it has such a profound impact that I don't think people fully appreciate it.
That's great. I mean, yeah, I liked that too, particularly with Afterlife and the direction that Jason wanted to take it and opening up that world to more than just, you know, a small group of adult male friends, that it could actually be bigger and be inclusive of family and all different kinds of people and places. And I think that's what's helped make it accessible to a newer generation of people too. Cause I think the original ones were very much, you know, in tune with what, you know, society and pop culture was at that time. And I think now these have tuned into what is likewise more popular now and cultural and funny, allowable, all those things. And it's nice to see. And it's nice to see people like yourself respond to it.
Well, it's one of those things where I've changed dramatically over the last 40 years. I would hope that the art that I appreciate would change along with that. And I think that that's, I like it when you can use a framework to express different ideas and thoughts and that it changes throughout time. It's kind of, you know, I don't think art should be static, you know, that it's just one thing, one where, you know, you have different periods of artist careers. And I love that this franchise does that. It does embrace different ideas and thoughts along the way, and that it is changing with the times. And the, I mean, it definitely is something that it's not what it once was, but it has more heart than it ever did before. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I personally have more heart.
I don't think it's a bad thing either. And that's always a difficult conversation to have when you're continuing with things that started when you say 40 years ago or more, that people who grew up with one version that had one experience when they're younger are always constantly wanting to recapture that with something new, a newer version of that. But we got to realize that if you want that feeling, you just got to watch the original. Things move. It's like, I dealt with this obviously with Star Wars too, is that, you know, there's that fan base is very opinionated and everybody wants what they think is the right version of what that franchise in, but it's a bigger thing. It's always changing. It's always growing, and it needs to, and it should, artistically, narratively. And there's no, like, you just because somebody doesn't respond as well to something that doesn't remind them of what they had originally loved about it, doesn't mean it's bad. Because for somebody else who's new to it, they might love it.
Absolutely. You know?
And that's going to be there. Like, my sons love the prequels for Star Wars. Absolutely love, because that's what they watched. That's what they first saw. And for me, I'm like 77 through, you know, Jedi. That's it. You know, that's all I want to talk about. And that doesn't mean I think anything's bad, but like, that's a special thing for me, that special place in my heart, and it always will be. So, you know, and, you know, with the Ghostbusters, like, it's obviously been very fluid. You know, 89 was very different than 84 even.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
You know, they got more heart. They got a baby in it. It got a little softer, a little more, the comedy changed with a little bit, you know, the comedy got slightly broader, but it was still very fun. You know, even 2016, look, they tried to do something that was elevated and more fun, you know, with this woman who's very amazing actresses.
Yes.
And it was great. It was really well made, you know, and the people were, you know, dumping on it. I didn't understand the dumping on it. It was like, it was a great movie. It was very entertaining. You know, and it did well.
Yeah.
You know, but like the kind of the originalists were like, oh, it's nothing like the original. Well, it's not, they weren't trying to make it like the original. They were trying to like take it and say, oh, this world's actually bigger. You know, and like, I commend them for that. And it was very funny. And then we did something different with Afterlife, you know, and then we tried to do something very different with Frozen Empire too, using the cast from. So, you know, I think these things should be allowed to change and evolve. And I like the way that we did it with Afterlife and Frozen Empire a lot.
So do I. I like every iteration of this, that they are doing different things in each one of them. They are unique and they're kind of their time, but there's something that is, it's very strange to have five films told over this span, this long span of time, that are all stand up on their own in their own ways, that they are very unique movies. And I do appreciate about this series. And it's kind of,
well, good, because I'd like there to be more voices, more loud voices talking about how much they love it versus the loud voices that seem to dominate discussions about how much people dislike something.
And sometimes it's weird. We have, I think most of us, especially, you know, people my age, our age, that some of your favorite albums are probably things you didn't get your head around. Same films, the first viewing, you're just like, yeah, it was fine, whatever. But then you go back to it for whatever reason, and then it just starts to really resonate. And those become the things that you just really appreciate. And I think that people, they don't give themselves that leeway if they don't love something completely with all of themselves right out of the gate, and it's not the exact thing they wanted, they get pissed off at it. And it's
right.
Sometimes, you know, I think it's good to have things that you don't know that you wanted. Right. It's what I hate about algorithms, you know, that it's this idea of, I'm not going to expand my taste beyond what I think I want, that it's just these things. You like these three things, therefore that's what we're going to keep pumping to you. And you know, if you go through and look through that wall back there, it's not just one thing. It's, you know, there's as much high-minded stuff. You know, there's the Bergman box set next to the Star Wars box set up there. And that's kind of how I think most people are, that we have that duality to our taste.
Well, you should. And that just shows a love of storytelling in film, you know, and that it's not limited to a genre or a director or a kind of movie, you know. Yeah. That's how you know somebody truly loves film.
But I guess for some people, it could be something that's a little bit more disposable, where it's a distraction for them. Yeah. I am somebody that takes this stuff possibly a little bit too seriously, a little bit more thoughtful than I should be. It's taken up large swaths of my life. But I have a tough time understanding people who aren't a little bit obsessive about art. And so it doesn't have to be film. If it's, you know, music or writing or, you know, sculpture, anything, if you don't have engagement with creativity, it's difficult for me to understand that, because it's such a fundamental part of my life.
I always thought that people who were like, yeah, I don't really care about movies that much, I just find that they haven't really watched the right movies. I haven't been exposed to it. And I'll be like, oh, have you watched this? Did you watch this? Watch this? And they're like, no. And I'm like, go watch some of these movies. Like, just put them on. Like, don't even commit to watching it. Just put it on and see if it, you want to watch more, the whole thing. And I guarantee you, if you find the right movie, you will be transformed. I mean, a good movie is just like, I mean, you know, I'm preaching the choir, but it's just, I mean, and I've got hundreds and hundreds of them. Somebody asked me, like, it's the worst question you can ask me. What's your favorite movie? I'm just like,
I take it too seriously. On what day? Answer it.
In what year?
Yeah.
You know? Which version of Eric, you know?
I can't even answer that. What's your favorite film by this person in this genre? It just doesn't exist. Like, it's, you know, what's your favorite Kubrick film? That really does depend on the day, what I'm looking
for. Totally depends on the day. You know, what's my mood?
Yeah.
You know, like maybe this year I'm in a Strangelove mood. Who knows? You know, because, you know, I'm into political satire or whatever. You just can't. Yeah. So anyway, but like, I do feel that film can be very strong and affect people in really profound ways. And I think it can with everybody. And there are those that will acknowledge it, and then there are those who just haven't seen that film, the right film yet.
So if you had somebody that had, just out of curiosity, not your favorite, but what would be a recommendation for you? A film that somebody that maybe has only really been exposed to large studio blockbuster kind of stuff, and you want to open them up to something.
I set myself up for this one.
This episode of the Following Films podcast is brought to you by Bookmans. So today I went into Bookmans and decided to try to find a film by Michael Mann. I went over to the Blu-ray section and saw copies of several films I already own, and then I found it, Black Hat. This is one I haven't seen in quite a while since it came out, and I figured maybe it was time for a reassessment of this much maligned film. So Black Hat is a cybercrime thriller directed by Michael Mann that delves into the world of cybercrime, hacking, and international intrigue. While it promises to be a gripping exploration of the dangers lurking in the digital age, the execution falls short of expectations. The film follows convicted hacker played by Chris Hemsworth, who's temporarily released from prison to help the American and Chinese authorities track down a criminal network that's responsible for a series of major attacks. As the hunt takes them across the globe, Hemsworth's character must navigate the murky waters of the criminal underworld while grappling with his own demons. One of the film's major shortcomings is its lack of technical accuracy and realism. While it attempts to portray the world of hacking authentically, it often falls into cliches and inaccuracies that ultimately undermine the credibility of the story. So the hacking sequences are exaggerated and unrealistic, relying more on flashy visuals than genuine technical expertise. And this is coming from an absolute layman. I am not somebody who knows anything about hacking, and yet I can see some of the things that just flat out aren't true in this film. And that particular disconnect may disappoint viewers familiar with the subject matter or looking for a more grounded portrayal of cybercrime. So despite these flaws, though, Black Hat does have its moments. Michael Mann's signature style is evident in the film's beautiful, sleek cinematography and the signature action sequences, and the international setting adds depth to the narrative. It highlights the global nature of cyber threats and the challenges of international cooperation. Chris Hemsworth delivers a solid performance as Hathaway, bringing the character a sense of depth who's grappling for redemption. And the supporting cast includes, I had no idea, I'd completely forgotten this, but Viola Davis, who's really great in the film and adds a lot to the film. But ultimately, Black Hat falls short of its potential. While it offers a glimpse into the world of cybercrime and espionage, its lack of technical accuracy and reliance on cliches detracts from the overall experience. And despite its flaws, fans of Michael Mann's work or of the cyber thriller genre, I guess if you're a huge Johnny Mnemonic fan and you're looking for some more cyber thriller, you could do worse than Black Hat. However, for those seeking a more realistic, nuanced exploration of hacking and cybersecurity, this might leave you wanting more, and I'm not sure I can recommend this one. But despite that, this gave me the chance to check out a film that I've been meaning to reevaluate, because I keep hearing that Black Hat is an underrated film, and maybe I'll give it another 10 years, follow back up with this one, and see if it does end up coming around for me. But remember, Bookmans, they have your cool covered. Hope you enjoy the rest of the show. Thanks.
Okay, so like the studio, okay, so if it wasn't a studio, oh man.
It could be a studio movie that has like,
No, I understand, but I know you're talking about like the big summer tentpole that's all they ever went to, or like the big comedies or something. Like, what would be something that was smaller? And I mean, look, I would like independent films of the 90s, you know.
That's me.
I mean, honestly, like I would almost suggest like find the smallest, most independent film you can. Just start with like Sundance in the 90s. Start with like Sex, Lies, and Videotape and El Mariachi and like Reservoir Dogs and Red Rock West, and
oh, like, that's a great one. That is an underappreciated movie. God damn, I love
Red Rock. You know, just like the stuff that you could only see, the stuff that you used to walk by all the time on the shelf at the video store that would always catch your eye, but you keep coming back to, you're like, maybe not today. And you know, just like the kind of more obscure with like the actors that you recognize, but a film that's that you never heard of.
Yeah.
You know, so that it's interesting enough because you like the actor. Right. But you'll take a chance because you've never heard of the film. And then go from there. And then after that, maybe go back and watch old black and white films. I don't know. Go watch Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf or Citizen Kane or something, you know? Anyway, I say that because I've been doing it with my younger son, and he's like, he's like, there's so many good movies. I was like, I know. You know, he's currently on a Quentin Tarantino thing, as we've been going through the Tarantino library, and he's just mesmerized, you know, by, he's like, his writing is so good. It's like,
yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's a rough standard to set yourself up to. You know, you kind of need to have a balance there where if you say, you know, I want, that's the, what you have to have to write to the Tarantino level is pretty rough, but there's a lot of films that are not as well written.
No, sure. I mean, there's definitely, yeah, that's, I mean, that is kind of like, I mean, that's what's familiar to people, but I mean, there's so many, I mean, you know, again, Soderbergh was just killing it in the '90s and always like he's an excellent storyteller, but there's just all kinds of, I still run into people that are like, I've never seen the first Star Wars. I've never seen The Godfather. I'm like, just stop what you're doing. Like, no, those aren't my kind of movies. I'm not into mafia movies. I'm not into space science fiction. I'm like, no. Like, forget, stop categorizing it. Whatever you think it is, it's a story. They're amazing stories, and that's why they're good. That's why people love them. It's quotable dialogue. It's memorable scenes. And you're going to realize as you're watching these movies that you've heard people quoting and saying things that are from these movies that you never knew that they were from these movies. You know, I remember watching The Godfather once for the first time with somebody, a friend of mine, and they're like, this is so good. I was like, yeah, there's a few more too. Like, oh my God, how do they do this? Or watch, you know, the crime movies of the '70s, you know, watch all the New York crime movies in the '70s, watch The Conversation, watch, you know, or watch like Parallax View or,
oh God, I love Parallax View.
You know,
I
mean, Pelham 123 or 3 Days of Condor.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like, there's so many good movies.
I don't know.
Or people who haven't seen Jaws, who think they feel like they've seen it, but actually haven't, you know?
When you go back and you start seeing things in there and, you know, it's talking with my 8-year-old who is becoming obsessed with film. And he hasn't watched all of Jaws yet, but, you know, explaining like, you know, kind of the rack focus thing and showing him these shots and how that works and talking to him about, you know, how you can change perspective and what that means and how you can convey ideas through it. And now he's into this big Bernard Herrmann kick where he just asks to listen to his music when we drive around. And it's just, I love it. And it's just, you can connect to that emotion through it and you can see how you can convey emotion. And yeah, as far as like the indie stuff of the '90s, absolutely. That's my DNA. That's the stuff that absolutely imprinted on me. I think you have to get a little bit deep before you start getting into like, you know, The Addiction or Nadja and those kinds of films from that time period. But it's you're right.
Soderbergh's like, a great Kieslowski's movie. Like you get into like Blue and all those, you know, the foreign stuff.
Oh, but, the trilogy.
Yeah, the trilogy. But and there's so much. Anyway, like we could talk about this for hours. No. But I'm just saying, like, you know, it gets back to the whole, you know, if film is can be so powerful and provocative and interesting to so many people. And I feel like there are those who have had the experience and there are those who haven't had it yet. And there's really nothing in between. People actually, everybody loves movies. They just don't know it yet. If they don't.
Could not agree with you more. And, you know, just to tie this together in that way, I think you can feel when people are thoughtful in the movies that they make. That it could be something that is a tentpole summer movie that's coming out on thousands and thousands of screens, but that it has something more to say, that it has a, you know, it's not heavy handed and it's not hitting you with a sledgehammer, which is what I love about these little films that you're putting together, that, you know, that they, I call them little films because they do feel very small and intimate despite the scope of these things. I mean, Frozen Empire is the biggest Ghostbusters movie to date, I think, probably as far as the size and scope of it, but it feels the smallest in so many ways to me.
Yeah.
Now there's an interpretation of this that could be like a stage play.
Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree. Because I think at the heart of all Ghostbusters are really kind of intimate stories.
Yeah.
You know, interpersonal relationships. So set against these very funny, absurd ideas. But yeah, and I think that's what largely made Ghostbusters so loved.
Could not agree with you more.
Combining those things.
Could I know we're over time, but one last question I just have to ask in here. Picking up new technology along the way, somebody who's shooting on 16mm, getting back into that area where you started from, you know, from shooting 8mm and like low def video stuff, to using drone photography in this one. Mm-hmm. What is that like? It's just the technician aspect of it and picking up, because not just the drone catching, but the way that you are shooting things, I feel like there were drones in here, possibly.
Yeah. All the drone stuff was done by our second unit. However, you know, we all talked about, you know, how things were going to be done. I think what it shows is that, like, the technology ultimately doesn't really matter. It helps you do certain things, but as far as storytelling, it doesn't matter. It just, they're all tools, right? They're all tools to help tell a story, and you use the best tools available for whatever that part of the story you're trying to tell. Like, I can't tell you how nice it is to go back to shooting film and even 16 millimeter, just like as simple as it gets, like the simplest camera, one of the, you know, the literally the oldest film stock in the world. I mean, 16 millimeter was invented before 35 was. It was invented in the 1919 or something by Kodak. And it's still the same exact, physically the same exact size and everything. The sprocket holds everything as it was 100 years ago. And so we're going back to the basics quite literally. And there's like no visual effects. There's no blue screens. It's, and I'm using old lights. There's no LED light. It's just, it's great. And yet on the last movie, I was using like the newest high definition or, you know, digital cameras. I'm shooting anamorphic for Frozen Empire. We're using drones. I'm using all LED lighting. We're programming it with lighting boards. We're doing animated lighting effects. I'm just about as high tech as you can get with image making. Tons of visual effects. And having those two things back to back is really interesting, because you're like, oh, well, it's just, we're still telling the same story, and the tools don't really matter. They help, right? Like, you wouldn't do Frozen Empire in 16, but not because it's just not the right thing.
No.
It's not the right tool. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but in the same way, like shooting on an Aeroflex Alexa large format with anamorphic lenses for Saturday Night Live would not be good. It just would not be good. It's not right for the story. Much like the way you cast certain actors for a role. I mean, we're casting the technology or the tools, you know, and you've got to use the right ones. It's interesting. It just, the storytelling is in a bit of a bubble, you know, and independent of all that stuff, but you want to obviously help it along and present it in the best way. And that's where the tools come in, but you really got to, like, it doesn't affect the storytelling, which is kind of fun to see or realize, especially, I mean, this is about as extreme as you can get. Having going from that kind of a movie to this kind of a movie is refreshing and eye-opening and really cool. It's definitely a bit of a reset, but creatively, but it's a nice reminder that you don't need anything fancy to tell a story.
Well, it's kind of the work that you're doing a lot of times should be invisible, that it should feel that's how you tell that story, that, you know, if you are doing this and it calls attention to itself, you can have flashy shots and things that move around quickly and things that look pretty and that are beautiful, that, you know, you were clearly, you know, trying to get your Badlands shot in or whatever that is that you're going for. But that's, if it's in support of the narrative, though, it shouldn't be what you're focused on at the time. And, you know, if you, it kind of, you just give into it and let go of that. You know, is there a version of Ghostbusters that could be told in black and white on 16 millimeter? Maybe there's a mumblecore version of that out there.
Don't tempt me. Maybe I'll pitch that.
I don't know how people would react. That would be something that it would call attention to itself, though. You'd have to have a very specific story to go that way. And so I think, like what you're saying with Saturday Night Live, that's something that just feels like the right way to tell a story in that time period, in that night that you're trying to capture, that day that you're trying to capture, that's it makes sense to do.
I hope so. You know, I mean, look, I've done plenty of movies where, you know, we tried things that did not work in the end, or maybe the movie didn't work also, but, you know, you try and you try to make the movie that you set out to, that you think will be the right version of it. But I think this one will. Like, I have a good feeling about this one.
When is this coming out, by the way? I know you're in the middle of shooting still, so no idea.
Dude, no idea. No idea.
Oh, man.
But I don't think there's going to be a whole lot to the post process, so, you know, hopefully it'll go quick.
You get to get your hands on actual physical film. You have the tactile experience of going through. That's great. Good for you, man.
Oh, I do. I got a whole bunch of pictures ready to share when the time is right.
That's awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to it. And hopefully we'll get to connect again on that one. It's every time that the two times I've talked to you, it's just been, I've been super excited about the project you're there to talk about, but it's also the one ahead that I'm also very excited about. And goddamn, man. Well, good for you.
I don't know what the next thing is. So, which is a little strange. I'm a little nervous about it, but no, I'm sure it'll be fine. I'm completely focused on this, and I'm actually looking to maybe a little bit of time off. I'm hoping the next thing, whatever that is, will be equally as exciting. But yeah, no, you've hit me at a very fortunate time in my life and career. So hopefully we'll keep it up.
You're reliving all of my childhood fantasies right now. So congratulations on that, man.
My own as well. Believe me.
If somehow you are like involved in another Conan the Barbarian reboot, then that's it, man. That's just like,
that would be so much fun. Oh my God. Would that be fun? I'd love it. Yeah. God, that would be amazing.
Yeah. It's one.
I'll let you know if I hear anything.
I mean, Arnold looks great for that King Conan right now. I think that he would just be the elder master. I think that movie needs to be made. So if Jason Reitman wants to take a stab at that version of it,
I'll let him know. Yeah.
I know that's not how it works, but thank you, man. I appreciate it.
No, it's good seeing you again, Chris.
Good to see you again. Take care. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Right. Thank you.
All right. You too. Bye.
Time enough to figure you out. Time enough to write this down. Wish me luck, give me hope. voice crack.